Over what we have discussed last time on generative modeling. Before going into that, I just thought it would be good to again provide a brief summary of what we have learned so far in the course. So one of the first lectures talked about supervised learning, where we have learned linear models such as linear regression and logistic regression, and we've also seen more advanced models like nonlinear models. Based on deep learning, so we've seen feedforward neural networks and also convolutional neural networks, which we will cover today in the tutorial. And we've also seen techniques for how we optimize these models, namely gradient descent optimization techniques. And also we've seen ways we could cure the phenomenon of overfitting in the context of supervised learning. In the last few lectures, we also learned about the paradigm of unsupervised learning, where in this case, we don't have labels compared to the context of supervised learning. So we only have data points. So we've seen two main applications. The first one is dimensionality reduction, where we learned about two techniques. The first one is principal components analysis, which is a linear method for doing a projection into a lower dimensional space. And we've also seen a nonlinear method called TSNE, which also serves for the same purpose. And lastly, in the second half of the previous lecture, we've seen generative modeling, where the main philosophy is that given a certain data set, a training data set, which only contains data points again, no labels, so this data set supposedly will come from some data distribution, some probability of data that we don't know a priori. So the goal is to find some model and to optimize it so that we can have an approximation of this data point, of this, sorry, of this probability of the data. So one way of doing this is by choosing some generative model. So the goal of this lecture will be to tell you about all the different choices that we can have for this generative model. So we will have some parameters lambda, and then we will train this generative model in such a way that we have a good approximation. And if we have a good approximation, then we could take this model and sample new data points. Okay, so this could be, for instance, new configurations, like new images, new molecules, new spin configurations. So you could imagine that this could be applied to many areas of science and beyond. And commenting on that point of training, so we've seen that we can actually map this learning problem of this probability of the data into an optimization problem where what we do is we optimize or we minimize the negative log likelihood, also known as NLL. So you'll see a lot of this notation in the paper. So whenever you see NLL, that stands for negative log likelihood. And we've seen that actually related to the KL divergence between the data distribution in the model distribution. We've seen that that is a good choice for a cost function because it's upper bounded by lower bounded by zero, and it's always and that value where it's zero stands for the case where p data is equal to p lambda. Okay, and one last thing we also covered in the previous lecture is the fact that the maximum likelihood estimation principle, which stands for the fact that we should always maximize the likelihood, is actually equivalent to minimizing the negative log likelihood. And it's actually more numerically convenient to minimize the negative log likelihood because the likelihood is that something that's very small because we multiply a lot of numbers that are smaller than one. Typically, the size of the data set could be 100, 10,000, 100,000. So multiplying a lot of these numbers would give us a very small number. So applying the log would allow us to optimize something that's reasonable. Okay? So far, so good. Okay, so I just thought it would be good to summarize what we have learned so far. And just to get you more excited about generative modeling, I just thought I would share some slides about that, just so that you know why generative modeling is so exciting. if we talk about generative modeling, like one directly would could think about ChatGPT, which is one powerful generative model, where here you see an example of where I give a prompt to ChatGPT to explain generative modeling to a 5-year-old kid. And you'll find that it does that actually very well. So you might say that's something that you're already familiar with because you're used to using ChatGPT for more advanced tasks. So one advanced task that we could use for models like ChatGPT, like this one called DALL-E, where here, like I'm giving a prompt to generate a picture of a pencil and watercolor drawing of a bright city in the future with flying cars. And you can see it does that actually very well. You can see pencil color, flying cars, and some sort of a city for your future. So that's something very cool. Another thing that I've done today, just to get you more excited about this. So I actually uploaded a picture of Perimeter and asked DALL-E to generate the picture of Perimeter as if it was on Mars. And I also instructed DALL-E to provide examples for scientists entering the building. And you can see that's something that's really, really cool. So if you imagine that we could do this a few years back, I wouldn't believe that, but actually that's something that you can do today. So that's really cool. Another cool example was this prompt where I asked GPT-4 to create a mind map of AI applications and also asked to add an artificial brain icon in the middle. So you could imagine, so you see that it does that actually very well. So you see all the potential applications of AI, and so you could imagine that this can help you to start ideas for potential drawings or potential diagrams. So, and another potential application of these generative models is to help you to code. So for instance, here is a prompt of a variant of GPT-4 called Copilot, which where here I'm asking this Copilot to help me to help me find a support for integrating GPUs into my PyTorch code. So this is something you'll learn about today in that tutorial. But this is just an example where you could imagine that if you're getting stuck in your code, in your PyTorch code, you could get some help in these kind of tools. So that's so cool. Another example, I just wanted to highlight again that this possibility of generative models to generate music. So again, I just thought to make you hear this sample again. So this is something that it's also a possibility using generative models. And in science, we could also use generative models to do drug discovery. So here's an example here where scientists use generative models to have ideas for potential new molecules that could have very exotic properties. And these tools could be also used in physics, like cosmology, where here you see pictures that are generated by what's called the generative adversarial network, which we will learn about today. So those are in the bottom corresponds to generated convergence maps. So that converts to the weak lens in convergence maps. That's very helpful in the context of, I believe, dark matter. And those ones are actually the real pictures. So you could see that the structure are somehow similar. And something that's related to the topic of this course, these generative models are also useful in the context of quantum state tomography, where given some configurations that you can get from a quantum computer or some quantum experiment, you can actually start from a data set in the Z basis. So that's like one basis that you could use. And you can actually infer information about other computational bases. So you could, for instance, compute observables in the X basis, in the Y basis. And also you could compute challenging quantities like the entanglement entropy between two partitions of the system. And you could do even things like amazing things like making language modeling and using that for applications in quantum physics. So in this case, you see a language model used to do quantum state tomography. So that's an example for what's called a GHC state. So that's the example. So that's the reconstruction in the quantum computer, and that's the reconstruction given by this generative model. So So that was also very cool. And another application that I wanted to highlight, that's the last one related to my personal research, where we use these denatural models to find the ground state of many body systems. So we're given some Hamiltonian that we're interested in, H, for some unknown, for some quantum many-body system we could find by optimizing the parameters of this called, this so-called RNN, where which is something that would not be covered today, but that's be a topic that would be covered in the mini course in May. So hopefully you'll hear more information about that in the coming weeks. So the idea is that we can optimize the parameters of this language model and get an approximation of our ground state of interest in the ground state energy. So that's was thought it would be cool to highlight. So I just thought it would be good to share these interesting advances with you before sharing with you the different kinds of generative models that can be defined in this field, okay? So let's get started with the classification of the different generative models that we can define. So we have three kinds of generative models. So let me start with the classification of generative models. So we have three kinds of generative models. The first one is so-called exact likelihood models. The second kinds of generative models are the so-called approximate likelihood models. And the third one is the so-called implicit likelihood models. Okay. So this classification is actually originally comes from one NeurIPS paper by Jan Goodfellow. If you're interested, you can check out that tutorial paper in NeurIPS 2016. So you'll find that link on the lecture notes on the portal. Okay. So let's get started first with the first kind of generative models called the exact likelihood models. What do I mean by that? So this is the case. So these kind of models are the ones that are able to compute the likelihood that is given by this product exactly. Okay. So this is the class of models where you can compute this L lambda or the negative log likelihood exactly. Or can be computed. Let's say more precisely efficiently, because we could compute things exactly in other contexts, but the computation cost may be expensive. But in those kind of generative models, the computational cost is efficient, means that we can do that within reasonable resources that are not exponential in time. Okay. So the first kind of exact likelihood models are the so-called autoregressive models. And these gender models rely on the fact that you want to generate configurations step by step or variable by variable. So the autoregressive part comes from the fact that come from autoregressive models in the field of statistics, where a prediction in the future is based on the previous of the history of the previous variables. And here we're using that to generate a configuration sequentially, variable by variable. So to clarify this a bit more, let me explain what I mean by this. So autoregressive models are based on this decomposition of a joint probability of a certain data point x, where x is composed of, let's say, n components. So we can always write this joint probability into products of conditionals. So I can start by writing the probability of lambda of x1. So that's the probability of the first component. I can follow that by another conditional probability. So what will be that expression of the second one, in your opinion? So if I'm given x1, x2, until xn. So we'll have that term, and then another term over here, and then a final term over here. So what will be that second term, according to the probability chain rule? Does anyone have an idea?
Lambda vector x2.
Yeah, so P lambda of x2, but we will need something else. Okay, you're close.
Given
x1. Right, and let me write it using px3 as well so that it's clearer. So the following one will be the probability of x3 given x2 and x1, and so on and so forth, until we arrive at P of the last components PXN given X1, X2, until XN minus 1. Okay, so this is a probability chain rule. It's actually something that's pretty generic. So you can always write a probability, a joint probability of many components into the conditional probabilities that only involves one component, okay? So why this is interesting? It's cool because you're kind of decomposing a very hard problem into a product of simpler problems, because here, for instance, you could, if x is a sentence of words, then you could imagine that you're generating the sentence word by word. So x, so let me write that here. So x could be a sentence of words. And x1 could be one word, x2 would be the next word, and so on and so forth. And in other applications, x could be also pixels in a picture. So x will be the whole picture, and each variable will be one pixel, okay? So one pixel, of course, that will be in a in the RGB encoding, so we will have the size of each pixel. So let me write that. So each pixel in that case will belong to a space of 256 by 3, because we'll have three channels. And for instance, for the sentence of words, that will depend on the dictionary of size. So each word would belong to a space that has size corresponding to the dictionary size of the language you're interested in. So let's imagine something like 10K or even a 1 million, although that could be much larger in real-world applications. And for instance, in the context of many-body physics, this X could be, for instance, a configuration of spins. So you could think of a spin configuration as a sentence of words and use these kind of tools to for purposes that are related to many-body physics. So in this case, what do you think is the what we can call a dictionary size of one spin, spin 1/2. So what is the size of the dictionary for a spin? So how, what is it? So it's much simpler in the context of many body physics. So either we have spin up or spin down, okay? So now how does this architecture looks like? So I'm gonna do something that's pretty generic. Is it okay if I erase? Okay. So I'm gonna assume that I'm given some black box, which I'm gonna call the ultra-aggressive model. Which has some parameters lambda. So what this ultra-aggressive model is doing is it generates some vector y, which corresponds to the each conditional probability of generating the ith components. So that could be, for instance, the ith spin given the I minus one previous spins. So that in that case, for spins, that will be a two-dimensional vector. Let's talk about the example of spins for simplicity. So we have a two-dimensional vector that we sample. So you, for instance, that could be a vector that has 0.9 on the 0.9 of the probability of getting spin down and 0.1 probability to get spin up. So we could sample that. We could flip a coin, a biased coin, according to this probability. And then we sample from it to get the value of the ith spin. And then we could feed it back so that we can get the value of the ith plus one spin. And we could do this again and again until you get your full spin configuration sequentially, okay? One by one, okay? Is this procedure clear for everyone? Yeah. So this is the generic principle of ultra-aggressive models. And examples of these of ultra-aggressive models could include the so-called recurrent neural networks, RNNs. So these will not be covered in this course, but we will cover that hopefully in the mini course in May. So stay tuned for that. There are also other examples, namely one of the famous ones called transformers, which are actually one of the building blocks of ChatGPT. The so-called GPT models, which stand for generative pre-trained transformers. And actually like large models that belong to the class of transformers are actually what gives rise to what's called large language models. So you might hear this term LLM, so that stands for a large ultra-aggressive model, which belongs to this class of transformers. Of course, I'm just saying words over here. If you're interested, like this will become clearer if you want to attend the mini course in May, okay? And other models are called MADE or NATE. So this MADE stands for Mass Ultra-Aggressive Density Estimator, and NATE stands for Neural Ultra-Aggressive Density Estimator, which also belongs to this class of ultra-aggressive models. So I don't want to bombard you with a lot of names here, but I just wanted to let you know that there are choices that you could have for these ultra-aggressive models. Okay. Now, one question that you might ask is that, well, what if I already have a certain configuration and I want to infer what's the probability of this configuration given my ultra-aggressive model? So what if we want to compute, well, B lambda of x, given that we already know what's x. So here we assume that we want to sample a configuration, but here let's assume that we already know that configuration from our training data set, so that we can compute the negative log likelihood to do the training. So this step is called inference. So you might hear this technical term as well. So this is when you want to infer what's the probability of a certain configuration. So one thing you could do is use that vector over here. So we could, if you want to predict what's the probability of a certain configuration, this actually boils down to just computing the conditionals, right? So if we can compute the conditionals, then we can take the products and get the joint probability. So if you want to get one conditional probability, then we can get this vector at step I. And then we multiply that by the, what's the so-called, the one-hot encoding. Of x, of xi. So why is that a good choice? Well, over here, this vector contains, for instance, two probabilities. So 0.9 stands for the probability of getting spin down, and the remaining probability stands for the probability of getting spin up. So if I multiply that by a vector, if I do the dot product with this vector 0, 1, I will get at the end 0.9. So if in that vector stands actually is actually turns out to be the one hot encoding of the spin down. And if I do that with the other one hot encoding, then I will get 0.1, which will be the probability of getting spin up. Okay? So this is like the inference step, and getting the one condition, the conditionals would allow me to also get the products, to get the joint probability of the full configuration. And given the fact that here we use this one-hot encoding, I should note that these ultra-aggressive models are mostly suitable to discrete data. So spin configurations or configuration of words or pixels in an image. And also one important highlight I want to make is that since we have to do the chain rule, like we need to choose some order, right? So if we're given some spin configuration, we need to choose what is left and what is right. And that's actually introduced a bias, because we could have a symmetry that we should not distinguish between left and right. So in that case, we can add symmetries. So for instance, we could sample from left to right with a probability 1/2 and sample from right to left with a probability 1/2, and that can reduce the bias in this kind of generative model, okay? So the reason is that like we have this nice property that we can sample efficiently, but the price we pay is that we will not have good symmetry, so that's the way we could account for this bias. So that's the example of ultra-aggressive models, which is mostly suitable to discrete data. Now let's see another example of generative models that are suitable to continuous data, and those are called normalized inflows. And is our suitable for continuous data. So for instance, the position of molecules position of atoms or things like that. So variables that are continuous. So the idea is the following. So I want to start from some configuration or some probability that's easier to sample. So that could be, for instance, a Gaussian distribution. So it's always to sample these kind of configurations as long as they have the mean in the variance. So let me write that. So it doesn't have to be one-dimensional. So I'm just here doing the example of 1D Gaussian distribution. It could be also multidimensional. That's still also easy to sample. And the idea is to do some coordinate transformation. Using some function g of the variable z so that we can get a new variable x such that we can get a new probability p of x such that we get some complicated landscape. That can allow us to model some complicated probability distribution such that ones we could get from real data sets in the robot. Okay, so now instead of using the chain rule, we're actually using another trick, which consists of doing coordinate transformation. So we're doing transformations on the space, and we restore it in space using this function in such a way that we get a complicated probability. So before going to the math of these models, I just thought it would be good to give you a bit of intuition about why this is a good thing to do. So let me share the screen. So this is an example of an animation for normalizing flow, learning the distribution of these dots, which are corresponding to the data points that I have. And these, like this color bar by yellow, means the distribution, the initial Gaussian distribution of my normalizing flow. And this grid, like basically corresponds to my, like the metric of my space. And just to show you how space was distorted as I'm doing these kind of transformations. So this is like credit to Florian Marco, who's one researcher working on this field. Okay. So basically, like you see here that this model like is doing coordinate transformation. So it's distorted in space in such a way that it's trying to map to distort this Gaussian distribution to something that actually describes the data, and you can actually that's something that's happening with more transformations going on in the model. Okay. Mm-hmm. So is this clear for you? Yeah.
What are the data points here?
Yeah, the data points are the ones that are. Do you see these black dotted lines? Maybe they're not as clear.
But they're fixed, aren't they?
Yeah. So they are fixed. So those are given by the data set.
I see. So why would be the curvature, whatever is behind?
Oh, you mean this grid?
Yeah, that's what's changing, right?
Yeah, so that's actually like we're changing from the Euclidean like metric that's the ones where the variable z live on to something to a new metric where we have a new variable x that describes
the data set.
Yeah.
What goal are we trying to achieve here by manipulating this space?
Yeah, so we want to describe like the distribution of the data points, the black data points, in such a way that we actually have an approximation of the underlying probability distribution. So this way we can generate new data points from
turn it into one-dimensional space?
No, it's just a way to like describe these data points using this model. So we start from something simple and we have something that's complicated that allow us to describe the underlying distribution, which we don't know a priori. We only have access to the positions of the data points.
Why is the end result better than the original result?
Can you clarify what you mean by the original results here?
When you started, before you started doing
all
calculations.
Yeah.
I just don't see why this is
coming. That's a great question, yeah. So initially, like we have something that's like looks centered around the middle, so that's a Gaussian distribution, and it actually doesn't describe these kind of data points. There are some black data points over here.
Oh, I didn't even see.
Yeah. So that's a good question. Yeah. So actually, like it turns out that it should like have a sort of a spiral. So we need to distort this initial Gaussian in such a way that at the end we get something like looks a spiral that also describes. Also gives a high probability to these data points.
Right, so yeah. That red line shows where it's going.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That's a great question. Another thing I want to show you is actually this density over here. So if I do, like, so this float length is corresponds to the number of transformations. So if I do only two transformations, I get something that does not look like a true distribution, but as I increase the number of transformations that I'm going to clarify in a second, I get something that gets closer and closer to my true distribution, okay? So that's the principle. Now let's see how we can do this mathematically, okay? So let's start with the 1D case. Actually looks like simpler, so it's good to start from this simple case so that you can be, so you're able to generalize to the multidimensional case. So we know that QZ is a probability density that should be normalized. So we can always write the integral of QZ DZ should be always 1. So now we have this with this coordinate transformation, we're using some function that's bijective, so that's very important. Because this way I can write the inverse of G. So I know that Z is equal to G minus 1 of X. So in this case, I can do a change of variable to write this new integral, which will look like Q of G minus 1 of X. So I just wrote that term over here. And now I'm going to need to transform that so that I have now dx over here. So I need to also divide by dx. And I also need to include the absolute value. So that's something you already know. It's like in when you do integrals, you have to include this absolute value. And if you do by correspondence, this should be the expression of P of x. Okay? So P of x should be Q of j minus 1 of x times the dz over dx, absolute value. Okay, so that's the case in one dimension. Now, if you want to generalize to multiple dimensions, that corresponds to the case when we have multiple components. So what do you think would be the expression of B of X in that case?
You have like a Jacobian.
Exactly, that's a very good point. Yeah, so we'll have first this first term, which doesn't change. So we will have Q of G minus 1 X. And then we will have the Jacobian matrix, but now instead we'll have the determinant of that Jacobian matrix. So you might have seen this result before. When you do a change of variable, you get the determinant of the Jacobian, okay? And that's also an absolute value. So just a note here, that's the Jacobian of the transformation. Okay. And one interesting thing about that we need to note about this transformation is that we need to design this Jacobian in such a way that it's easier to compute the determinants. In one choice of a transformation that we could have could be, for instance, the case when we take the Jacobian matrix to be, for instance, a triangular matrix. If I choose, for instance, a lower triangular matrix, I know that if I take the determinant of that matrix, the determinant will be just a product of the diagonals, which is much more cost effective compared to taking the determinant of some generic matrix, which scales as the cube of the size, which is here, where here we only have a linear complexity with the size, because we have only n diagonal elements. Okay, so one example of such transformations that satisfy this property is the following. So as an example, one could choose like one elementary transformation which maps z1 to x1. So imagine we only have two components, just for simplicity. So we're going to map z1 to x1, and x2 will have the following expression: z2 times the exponential of some function s of z1 and plus some another function t of z1. Okay. So why that will give you this? So we need to compute the inverse map. So that's the map of G. Now we need to compute G inverse. So now we need to find z as a function of x, okay? So for the first equation, that's easy. I just need to inverse the order. But for x, now for z2, I need to actually move that term over here and also the exponential to the other side. So I will end up with x2 minus t of z1, where I know that z1 is x1, so I could write that as minus tx1. And I also have that term, which will be on the other side, which will be the exponential of minus s of z1, where I know again that z1 is x1. So that will be the exponential of minus xx1. So this way, I managed to write z as a function of x. And now I need to find the Jacobian. So what I can do is compute the Jacobian matrix J, which is the derivative of z with respect to x. And then that component will be the derivative of z1 with respect to x1. Here, the derivative of z2 with respect to x2. And here, the derivative of z2 with respect to x1. And here, the derivative of z1 with respect to x2. Okay. Is everything clear so far? Okay, so the derivative of z1 with respect to x1, that's just 1. The derivative of z2 with respect to x2, so I only have that exponential factor over here. So that's the exponential of minus s x1. Now, the derivative of z1 with respect to x2, so that's 0 because I don't have a dependence on x2. And it doesn't matter. I don't need to compute that term because all I need at the end is to compute the determinants. So I just needed to make sure that this is a triangular matrix. So basically, the determinant will be that exponential of minus s2. And so that's only an example of one transformation. So that's what you could think of as a one flow. So you could actually do multiple transformations. So you could reiterate this. And one nice thing about reiterating this is that you could show that the product, that the total Jacobian matrix is actually the product of the elementary Jacobians. So So the total Jacobian matrix will be the total, will be the product of the different Jacobians that correspond to these elementary transformations. And as you might have guessed, the determinant of this Jacobian matrix is just the product of the different simpler Jacobian matrices. So step by step, you can actually build more complexity and build a more complicated probability distribution given by that Q of J minus 1 of X times that determinant over here, which corresponds to that determinant of the matrix J over here. Okay? Is this clear for everyone? Okay, so this NF is a number of flows, and that's a hyperparameter that you have. And as we've seen in the animation, the more, or in the demo, like the larger this is, the more complicated our probability P of X will be at the end. Okay, is this clear for everyone? Like, yeah.
How do we obtain the different Jacobian matrices J1, J2, and J9?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So I should have clarified that over here. So that J over here, so that could be, for instance, like a Ji. So that's one example of these matrices Ji. So each time, like we do, like one transformation, then we will get a new Jacobian matrix, and at the end we'll get the product. And though, actually, I should also note that these, for instance, this function S has parameters inside that are correspond to trainable parameters, so we can learn the transformations during the optimization. Okay, so let me write that. So that's a learnable. Function. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. How do we train this? So we have those learnable parameters and
yeah.
the Jacobian matrix, and we find the Jacobian matrix by taking the product. Like,
yeah. So after getting the Jacobian matrix, we will get that P, and then we can compute the likelihood. So, yeah. I erased it. So we can compute the likelihood, and we can minimize the negative log likelihood. And then at the end, we expect that our probability P of X will be closer to the probability of the data, and we can generate new data points out of that. Does that clarify? Okay, so for the sake of time, let me move on to another type of generative models called the approximate likelihood models. As the name suggests, like these models correspond to the case when the likelihood can be computed efficiently. So an example of this are the so-called energy-based models. Are actually inspired by physicists since the 80s. So one example of these are what's called Hopfield networks. Hopfield networks. So the form of the probability of the model is something that looks like a Boltzmann distribution, where we have an energy that depends on some parameters, lambda, of some configuration over the partition function. And one example of this energy is something that looks like this, where we have like interactions between, like, let's say, different spins, which can be interpreted, for instance, as a pixel of an image. So that's where an application where physics can help machine learning. So you can imagine that we have like this, like couplings between different spins, like which serve as weight matrices. And also we could imagine that we have magnetic fields serving as biases. Okay, and these could be tuned in such a way that we could describe something that's could model the some probability of some data distribution. Okay? And the challenge is actually comes from this partition function z. So you know that partition function z lambda is the sum over all possible configurations so that we have this normalized. And you know that we have an exponentially many configurations. So for instance, if we have spins, again, we have this cursive dimensionality where we will end up with an exponential number of terms to the end. So we need approximate ways of handling these methods, of these models. And there are ways of doing this, like so we could rely on approximate sampling methods, like the one we've seen for in one of the previous lectures, Monte Carlo sampling using Metropolis, where one interesting observation we can make is that although we cannot estimate the partition function, but if we can compute the ratios of different probabilities, that's actually something we can compute efficiently. So if we can compute, if we take the ratio of two different probabilities, that's the exponential of minus the energy of the second configuration over the exponential minus the energy of the first configuration. So what this means is that we can do like sampling techniques like Metropolis sampling, which is covered in the lecture notes in one of the previous lectures, and maybe those who took numerical methods would know more about this sampling technique. So this is like how we could get new configurations out of these energy-based models, and I have also talked about the way we could train them, so that's something I could also cover later on if you come to the office hours, okay? So before show, like, for the interest of time, I wouldn't have a chance to show you everything, but I could cover. So I wouldn't have a chance to tell you about implicit likelihood models, but I will take a chance to finish the approximate likelihood models by the end. So let me do that here. So another example of approximate likelihood generative models is the so-called autoencoders. Where I have some network, like neural network, for instance, that's called an encoder, which maps some initial like configuration or x to what's called a latent variable z that has a smaller size. So if this is n dimensional, this like has dimension n prime. So this is has dimension n prime, and this is n, where n is smaller than n prime is smaller than n. And then what we do is we feed that to another architecture, which is called the decoder. And that allows us to obtain a reconstruction of that initial input x. Okay, so if we train this, so the loss that we could use to train this architecture is the difference between the reconstruction x hat and x, the data points that we have in our training data. So by minimizing this, then this can allow us to find a good representation or a compressed representation of each data point. And out of this compressed representation, we can generate new data points, okay? So this allows to compress data and to only keep the relevant information that allows us to generate new pictures. So for instance, one thing we could do, for instance, is start from a four-dimensional data points and go to a two-dimensional space and then go back to a four-dimensional space. And then another thing we could do is we could drop this encoder and then take new values of this latent variable so that we can generate maybe new configurations. So that's an example where we could do generative modeling. And maybe I'll have time to show a demo for these autoencoders. And I'll talk maybe briefly about the other class of generative models called the implicit likelihood models.
The goal is you want to use less memory, right?
Yeah, so you compress the inputs. You could compress maybe an image to something that's smaller, and then you could generate new pictures out of this smaller representation.
Okay, I guess it's generated because the new picture doesn't have to be the same.
So this will become clear after this demonstration over here. So here I have the handwritten digits, the MNIST data set. So here I'm starting from, this is just an illustration, like I'm starting from a six-dimensional space and I'm going to a two-dimensional space. So that's the encoder part, and that's the decoder part. Which maps a two-dimensional input to a six-dimensional input again, which stands, for instance, for that picture, which is, of course, has a higher dimension. This is just for the purpose of illustration. So initially, like if I don't train much, the reconstruction does not look like a three over here. But if I train for more, for instance, you could see that the construction gets better. And if I train for more again, the reconstruction will get even better. So let me do that for more train steps. Okay, so now by more training steps, the reconstruction is getting better and better. And of course, that's only an example for reconstruction for data points that already exist in the training data. Mm-hmm. One could also sample a new configuration that does not exist in the training data and gets a good results. So for example, for this image of a seven, we still don't have a good result, so we could train for more. And you could get a good representation for a seven by doing more training steps. As you see here. So it gets better and better. And you could also see that it looks a bit noisy. So this picture looks like smoother than this one. And that's because we have compressed the picture to a lower dimensional space. Yeah.
So the goal is essentially to find this good intermediate step.
The goal is to find like a good representation or a good parameters that allow us to make this compression, because we could always choose like new variables and get a new picture or a new handwritten digits. Okay, and you could imagine that we could do also this for molecules, where you could start from you choose some random values for the latent variable and get some interesting molecule that could like have exotic properties for certain drugs. Okay, so there are lots of applications for these kind of tools. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
I think so. If the output is essentially the picture after we pass it through the encoder and the
decoder,
just seeing this picture, it seems a bit maybe I'm maybe missing the point.
Oh yeah. So that's like if I have like or like inputs, then I could like have a reconstruction. But if I drop that encoder, and if I only start from here by random values, then I can actually get some new pictures out of that. So that's the point of the generative modeling over here. At the end of the training, then we have to drop that encoder. Okay. Yeah.
If we wanted to take the high dimensionality as input and reduce it to a smaller dimensionality,
yeah,
would we take just the first hidden layer, or the first two, or the first three?
No, that's a great question as well. So the number of layers is a hyperparameter. The dimensionality of that latent space is also hyperparameter. Of course, the smaller the that late dimensionality of the latent space, the harder it is, the more challenging it will be. So
I just think part of this is trying to get back to what you want. But
yeah,
in reality, what you want is a reduction without the going back. So
yeah,
I don't quite see where you choose to cut.
Yeah, so for instance, if we choose something that's smaller, then we will have a chance to like sample like values that are within something we can handle. If we choose like still like a larger space similar to what was before, it will be harder to sample new values and then get a new picture at the end. So the goal is to start from something that like to like compress the picture to a smaller space where we can sample new values so that we can get again, a larger picture with what we want at the end. Does that answer your question?
So, I'm just struggling a bit with if I was going to take some of these layers and encode them into my original neural network, I'm just not sure whether I take the first one or first two or.
So you could play with like this architecture. You could first initially start with one hidden layer for the encoder and the decoder. If it doesn't work, you could try two and so on and so forth. The goal is that you start from a high dimensional input and then you reduce it step by step and then you increase it back step by step until you go back to the original reconstruction. Okay, so that was a brief overview about autoencoders. I didn't have a chance to cover the implicit likelihood models, but I just wanted to show you a demo for that, It turns out that there is an architecture, like a very famous one called generative adversarial networks, which have like a sort of two components, a generator and a discriminator, where they're playing a game. So you have a generator that's trying to generate configurations that looks like the real configurations. And you have also a discriminator that's actually trying to tell what is real and what is fake. So the fake are those that are generated by the generator. And at the end, it turns out that the generator will have a winning strategy by making configurations that looks like that are real, and the discriminator will not be able to tell which one is real and which one are fake. Of course, I went through that very quickly. Like, you'll find more details in the lecture notes. But I just wanted to show you an example here where if I have like this configuration of green dots, which looks like the green, like the true configurations that are in the train data, and if I do the training, the generator will start with these purple dots, which will look far away from the true distribution, and the color bar actually corresponds to the weights that is given by the discriminator. So green means that it's real, and purple means that it's fake. And at some point during the training, like later stages, I have saved that over here. So the generator will be able actually to generate data points that are close to the true distribution, to the point that the discriminator will have a hard time to tell what is real and what is fake. So for instance, here the discriminator is telling that it's real, which is not. So at this point, like, the generator will win over the discriminator, and at the end, you could take only the generator to get new data points. So you could use the generator that is trained until you get something like this. So you could see here, the samples we get actually look similar to the ones that are real. So, okay, so if you want to see more details, I would encourage you to see the lecture notes. And before ending the lecture today, just wanted to highlight that next lecture will be by Roger Malko, who will tell you more about all the recent advances in research in this field of machine learning and many body physics. So we encourage you to come. And today's tutorial will be about convolutional neural networks applied to the Eisengage theory. And again, next week, we'll also have a guest lecturer, Damien Pope from the Outreach team, who also will give you a lecture about machine learning using quantum computers. So far, I've told you about machine learning using classical computers, but we could also use machine learning for quantum computers or something that's called quantum machine learning. You have a question?
It would be like machine learning for quantum computing tasks or
machine quantum computers for machine learning. Yeah, quantum computers used for machine learning. So that's a different paradigm. And also, don't forget to send me your presentation topics by the end of this week, okay? Okay, well, thanks very much.